welcome to episode 34 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Break Room. I'm your host, Brad Schreffler. This week on the show, I am joined by a really good friend of mine, Chip Harbin. Chip is a former reading teacher, now behavioral dean, previously at a high school, now at a middle school, and he's also one of the most personable, funny, and all-around ridiculous guys I know. Chip and I talk about a lot, not all of it on topic, including class size and school size issues, the problems with funding, importance of building relationships with your students and your peers, and some interesting consequences of that, and what is easily the most unique answer to the best teacher question I've ever had. True to form, Chip gets off topic quite a lot, and if you ask me, this is the funniest episode of my show yet. So, sit back and enjoy episode 34 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Chip Harbin.
Technically,
I already started. We're not explicit. No explicit here.
You already started?
I mean, I can always cut it. It's not like a live recording.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Hi, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I'm your host, Brad Trevler, as always, and I am joined today, and at this point, this is a completely abnormal intro, so we might as well just dive right into it. I'm joined today by a very good friend of mine who I have worked with for years and now don't work with anymore, but who knows what the future may hold. And I am joined today by my good friend Chip Harbin. What's going on, buddy?
Hey, man. Everything's just trying to get this can balanced. We'll just leave that and don't explain what we're talking about because it makes it confusing and intriguing.
I like it. Maybe at the end. You have to listen all the way to the end.
If you really want to know about the can balance.
So we were at literally seconds before we hit record, we were starting to talk about how you're one of the only people that I've had on my list to be a guest from the beginning, like before I even started the show, who has actively avoided being on the show. I feel like you've completely avoided it. But not, I don't understand why, because I know you're going to make a great interview. Like, I know it's going to be a great episode, to the point that I'm now sitting in your office at your school so that I could just literally track you down and force you to do this.
It's because I don't like your first question.
You don't like my first question.
No, and that's been the reason, is since you started doing this, I have pondered over your first question, and I have still to this day have yet to hammer down anything that I feel like is even remotely correct, efficient.
I love that you're just banging a pen right next to that mic, too.
Or rational. That's good. Sorry. My bad. It happens. I had no idea what I would say because I've pondered over problems in education left and right, and there's no way. Every time that I go, oh, this is it, then I'll go, and then that leads to this, and that leads to this, and I'll go, wait a minute, I just named 13 different problems. He's asking for one, and that's an impossible task. It's saying what is the biggest problem facing education today is there are no problems facing education today, but every problem is facing education today. That's my answer.
That's your answer. Well, I haven't even asked yet. You've already answered it. You know, it's an interesting experience for a couple of reasons. Number one, you have been a listener of the show. You know what the show is. You were there in the inception stages as I talked through the process and figured out what I wanted it to be. And you're one of the people that I know listens to podcasts, so I came to you as I was thinking about this idea, and I also know you're into education and we're into the philosophies, and so we intersect on so many levels at that point that you were a person that I right away was like, I want to do this thing, what do you think, what should I say, and here's my plan and my questions, and you're right, you've said before, like, you don't have an answer. But I have that same experience on this side of the mic. You know, I've been a guest on shows where they've tried to get me to answer my own question. And I've always said the same thing. Like, I actually don't have an answer. You know, this is episode 30 something or other. And I've really yet to have someone give me the same answer twice. And none of the answers I've gotten are wrong. And that's the most terrifying thing of this whole show on some level.
I think I said that at some point. So you ask that question to 100 different people and you're going to get 100 different answers.
Yeah. And none of them are wrong.
And also, I don't like my voice. I've listened to recordings of myself or like my own voicemail. Every time I hear it, I'm like, God, man, people must think I'm such an idiot when they hear me on my voicemail. So that's why I just do the one where it just says your name.
But that's just you. Like, that's everyone feels that way about their voice, I think.
I guess so. I could try to jazz it up a little bit.
I was told when I did my last interview, I was told that I definitely have a radio voice, that yeah. I switch into radio voice.
I could, yeah.
I don't yeah. feel like I do. I don't no, notice
you
do. I do it.
You have like a more, what's the word I'm looking for? You have a more deliberate tone. To okay. your voice, like you're trying to get these words out.
They're very important words.
Yes. You're carving them out as you say them.
The description is probably much more artistic than I deserve.
Gotta get that can balance. Yeah. Okay. You still hadn't asked me.
We're in here. We've been going for a little bit, but we should start with who you are. You know, who are you? What do you do? And what's your role and your context?
My name is Chip Harbin, obviously. I am a dean over discipline at an incredibly overpopulated middle school in Central Florida. I'm the transportation liaison on campus. I'm one of the leads for the implementation of restorative practices on campus. Trained as a... English teacher, but never taught one day of English. And that's it. This is my fifth year in education. I have to renew my certificate this year for the first time ever. That's me.
Yeah. I'm on renewal this year too. I'm on year eight though, because I was on a 3-year temp, and now I have my first full certificate renewal coming up this year, and I'm like, as the CRT, that's one of my jobs, and I'm the first person I'm having to figure out how to renew a certificate for.
Yeah, I asked someone else who we both know who works here, yesterday about renewing my certificate, and our quote-unquote CRT was sitting next to them, and they were like, why are you not asking me this? I'm sitting right here. And I was like, oh, she's sitting closer to me than you are. That's the real answer for that, but I'm good.
I mean, you can say Mutters, if that's who we're talking about.
I mean, yeah, but why?
She's been a guest on the show. You're just, like, being unnecessarily secretive at this point.
I don't know where this conversation is going to lead.
Oh, okay. You want to protect her anonymity?
Yeah, it's like Dragnet. Like, you should just title this episode the Dragnet episode. Like, the interview you're about to hear is real. The names have changed. To protect the innocent. Or the guilty. At this point.
Who knows?
Either way. So, right. Because I just never know what I'll say.
That's a good point. So that's a good point.
Yeah, I'm a little more contained.
But you are after a long day of work, so a little of the containment has been spent, I'm sure.
Yeah, like I said earlier, should have thought this through. Should have planned this on a day when I was crisp. And that never happens.
Yeah.
Those days aren't real.
That would have been your next excuse to buy yourself more time.
Yeah. I'm not crisp today.
Too late. The recording started. So even if it's a 7.5-minute podcast, it's going out at this point. So,
mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I think we've preambled enough because I know it's been killing you. It's making you suffer. So let's just get it out there. What do you have for me? What is the biggest problem facing education today?
You know, the only things I can speak definitively about are the things that I've seen, the things that I've been a part of. And one of the biggest problems that I've seen is overcrowding. And it's an issue, and as simple as it sounds, or classroom size, or whatever you want to call it, as simple as it sounds, and how you don't think that that's an issue, or people think, well, you know, that could be solved, or they build relief schools 6 years after they're needed, or they do things, you know, to alleviate that. They don't. And it's a little problem. It's a small factor that I feel causes a ripple effect throughout all of the people that it reaches. Because you have a school like mine who or we are currently, I think, like 12 or 1300 students over capacity. And that gets to a point to where you have to hire more teachers, but you don't have money to pay that many teachers. So you have to try to suit your size with the teachers that you have. But then you have teachers who are getting burnt out and getting exhausted and feeling like all this is being dumped on their backs. You have people who are having to do 5 or 6 different jobs because just the sheer size of the school. Like, you know, we're in a middle school, and you're in a middle school, and that type of school is allowed certain positions because it's a middle school. But it's a middle school that's larger than most high schools. And so you get a lot of people who are doing a lot of things, and this has absolutely no reflection on how I feel about my job, because I absolutely love my job these days. And I'm so, so grateful for the people that I work with, but you can see it on people's faces sometimes. They come into work and they're just exhausted, and parents get upset, and discipline becomes an issue because you have students packed in like sardines in a can. They all have to walk through a gate at some point in the day. They're running into each other. They're bumping into each other. That's affecting their education. Trying to hire this many highly effective or high quality teachers is not easy as well. We registered 33 students on Monday. That's in one day. And there's not a single day that I don't come in that I don't find a code of conduct form in my mailbox where a student was registered the day before. So you can start a school out at the beginning of the year with 2,100, 2,200 students, even though your school was built to hold 1,200, and you start out with this many, and it increasingly grows and increasingly grows. So now in the middle of the year, you're looking for teachers, you're trying to get high quality teachers, and it makes it incredibly difficult, I feel like, for teachers to truly reach every student, which is the goal of education these days. That's the all-encompassing idea, is let's just, if I'm just rambling on,
you're good.
Throw a finger up and
that's how we roll.
Shut up anytime.
You've heard the show. That's how we roll.
Yeah. But it's because if the goal of education is to make it equitable for all students, that requires a lot of work. And a lot of that burden falls to the teachers. They're the ones who are there looking in the face of those students every day and having to make those decisions. And when you have to make those decisions for 100 kids, it's difficult. And I feel like these days, the majority of the accountability for student success is being placed on teachers, or at least on the expectations placed on those teachers. And that's difficult. And I feel like education as a whole would be much more effective if class size were smaller.
Well, and what's the limit on the class size? I mean, I think, and I ask that, I think ultimately if you really break that down, 90% of the time, the limitation on class size is a funding issue, right? I mean, the reason we have to have the class sizes the way we are is because the funding's not in place. You know, and I think that's where, you know, kind of like you said ahead of time, you know, when you get to one problem, it rolls into the next one, it rolls into the next one. But I think certainly the funding issue hits a lot of veins to be considered, you know, and that causes the class size. And it also is part of the reason we can't find high quality teachers. And it's part of the reason that the kids are having to go through two small gates and having the accountability hit us the way it is because our funding is tied to it. And, you know, I think ultimately that's kind of where you're at, is that funding issue is a major problem. And I think you're right, though, that one of the ways it hits us the worst is in class size.
Yeah, I mean, there are states out there that have just completely lifted class size or classroom size limitations so that they can just do whatever they need to do to keep teachers or to keep students in classes with teachers. But that's what I'm saying, is every time I thought about something, it would always lead me to go, oh, but that's because of this. And then, oh, but that's because of this. And oh, but that's because of this.
You know, I was actually thinking about it last night.
Too many people, man. America's just too big.
That's the problem. We're just all too big.
It's just too many people.
I was thinking about it actually the other night. I was like, you know, what would stop someone? And there's an obvious answer. But what would stop someone from giving teachers a five period schedule day instead of a six? You know, we give a lot of teachers a full 7-period schedule on it, you know, because we have the funding limitations and we can't find the teachers we need. So we give a lot of teachers a 6-period schedule or a 7-period schedule. But what if we gave them 2 planning periods instead of just 1? Like, how great would that be? We could actually do a PD every day of the week, and then they'd still have a planning period to work on grading and administrative tasks and everything else. Like, our balance has gotten so out of whack. And I think, again, back to class size, if we could reduce that class size, we could make that a reality.
Yes. If you could reduce class size, if you could reduce the number of students, because it's bananas for me if I have students who have discipline issues or something going on where they need a schedule change, they need to be separated, and there's literally no class I can put them in because every one of them is at capacity. It blows my mind. It blows my mind that of all the teachers and all the classrooms and all the periods that we have available throughout the day, that we can't squeeze one kid in one class at one point because they're all just slammed with kids. And so, I mean, that sounds great to give them 5 periods and have them have 2 planning periods, one they could use for planning and one they could use for PD or whatever else they could use it for. Remediation with students struggling, I mean, they could choose to do that if they wanted to. They could, I mean, there are lots of options. But that's like one of those in a perfect world scenarios. We would have the funding to do that, or in a perfect world, we would have a school that could accommodate all of the students that we have in a way that would make that possible. And we're not having to bring in portable classrooms and annihilate our field and our baseball field and everything on campus just so that we can house these extra 500 or 600 students we're going to start the year with next year. And eliminating all of that just so they can all be moved right back out the next year when a relief school is finally built. So, I mean,
hopefully.
Hopefully, because God knows what's going to happen. But
well, I think you're right. If you go to the idea that the ultimate goal of education is to reach every student, that has a variable cost. You know, in business terms, there's a variable cost to that. How the time it takes to reach every student is a factor of how many students you have. The more students you have, the more time it takes to reach every student.
Well, but isn't that like the name of the game in education is that the expectation raises constantly, but the amount of money being sent towards that expectation doesn't necessarily meet it.
Or goes down.
You know, I mean, like how if you look at, and I haven't, so don't ask me to give you data on this. But if you look at, let's say, take a teacher 10 years ago, and quantify the amount of expectation placed on that teacher, and then take a teacher this year, now, and quantify the amount of expectation placed on that teacher, and see how that's grown. I'll guess exponentially, but who knows? and then look at teacher pay 10 years ago, and then teacher pay today, and see how much that's grown, and see if it lines up. I don't know if it does. I have a very strong feeling it probably doesn't.
I'm sure the pay has increased more than the need. I'm sure that the pay has increased more than the expectations. Yeah, yeah. I'm positive.
That happens a lot. I actually, every day I have teachers constantly come up to me and saying, I feel like I'm getting paid too much for what I'm doing.
I just don't know what to do with all my time. I just have so much time.
Honestly. So much time and so much money. That's the life of an educator.
Oh man, you know, you're right. It's hard. It's so hard. And it does feel like a constant battle and a constant battle coming at you on all fronts. You know, I can agree with that. You know, I kind of feel like
but
you might be onto something.
I mean, and this is, it's weird. Because there was a time where I looked upon education as so negative. I was so negative. But I was also, at that time, not really in a good place in education. But now, I just... And this is another reason why I came to a struggle with your first question. Is I look around and I see, well, what's the number one problem in education? And I still, in the back of my mind, think there aren't any problems with education. The problem with education is that education is never going to be what we want it to be. It's just about doing everything that we can do to get us as close to that point as possible. It's never going to be perfect. But it's just there aren't problems with education. There is every single day a different challenge that we have to work to overcome. But there's nothing negative in that.
That's such a like, on one level you're like, we're never going to make education good, and then you're like, because it's already good, we're just never going to make it perfect. Like, on one level it's a singularly depressing thought that education's never going to be what we want it to be, and then on the other it's like, because it's pretty darn good now. And I don't know if I agree with you completely there.
Well, it's because, my God, I feel like what I'm going to say is just going to contradict me again. It is.
This is what it's always like talking to you, Chip.
It's one of the most. To educate a group of people, in my opinion, is probably one of the most difficult things a person can do. I mean, it's difficult to analyze and to take into account all of the differing lives outside of school, learning styles, preferences, emotions, attitudes, especially in middle school. Jesus Christ. Sorry. But it's so difficult. Where was I even going with this?
Education's good, not good. it's good, not good. Positive, education positive.
Education is horrible, magnificent.
It's horrible, magnificent.
I will stick with what I said about how I don't feel like we're ever going to achieve the level of success in education that we feel is necessary. But, and I think that is what causes people to view education negatively. That's what causes people to say things like, what are the biggest problems facing education?
A little subtweet at me there, but that's okay.
But I think if you can acknowledge that and if you can look at it and go, yeah, I understand that this thing that I'm working for, it's never going to be perfect. It's never going to get to that place where it's like, you know what? Education figured out, guys. Here's the formula. We got it. Here, other countries, you can use it. Our students, 100% satisfactory across the board because we've got it figured out. That's never going to happen. And if you can sit back and just accept that, then you come to work every day and you think, I'm just working as hard as I can to move in that direction, to think what I feel that idea of perfect education is and just working towards it.
Okay.
Maybe. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's almost a sense of like, no, it's never going to be perfect. That doesn't mean it's not good. Right? I mean,
right.
And like, I get it. I get that it's never going to be perfect. And it's probably different in every school, and it's different in every experience, and different in every county and state and part of the world as well, you know, globally. I just have a hard time looking around on the whole. Like, not individually. Individually, I can show you some bright spots of just brilliant teaching that is happening. You know, I mean, I've had a lot of them as guests on the show. And people that I know are doing phenomenal work every day. And yes, come in with that mentality that it's not perfect, but I'm going to keep pushing at it. And on that I get. I just feel like so often I look around and see the exact same thing I would have seen 10, 15, 20 years ago. Except maybe it's slightly brighter because it's on a screen now. Like that, and that's where a lot of my frustration comes from.
A resistance to change or apathy or
I think the reason for it is different for every person. I think some teachers are resistant to change. Some people don't buy that any change is necessary. Some people just don't care. Some people don't feel like they get paid enough. Some people are just completely and utterly overworked. Some people are in a scenario where they have 45 kids in a period and it's just too darn bad. I mean, I think it's different for every person why that's happening, but I think certainly while I agree with you, there are good things happening. I think to me, it feels short-sighted to say that it's pretty darn good and all we can do is keep pushing in that direction. And again, I think it's different. I think that's totally fine.
Because I think pushing in that direction means trying new things. It means developing professionally. it means being willing to take risks or being willing to look forward to the future instead of even like just getting comfortable in what you're doing. It's constantly analyzing your practice of like, well, what could I be doing better? Well, how did I handle this situation? Okay, well, this situation went this way, so now I'm going to make sure that I set some sort of a protocol for myself next time so that I don't make the same mistake again or so that I remember to analyze this. It's if people came in with, God, man, first of all, almost just used a swear word.
You caught it.
Yeah. I also hate throwing out like stupid educational jargon left and right because it drives me nuts when people do that. But having a growth mindset, I feel like, is just one of those things that sets people apart from each other and shows like one of the non-problems in education is when you see somebody with a growth mindset and somebody who's coming forward every day and saying, what can I do today to make sure that I am working towards that dream of fulfilling the perfect educational formula? What am I doing today to make sure that I'm reaching every student in my classroom? Because that's the goal of education. And so, I mean, that's why when I say I don't feel like there are like problems facing education, I think it's more of just solutions we haven't come up with yet. Wow. Is that weird?
It's a little weird.
You put that on a t-shirt.
It's a little weird. I don't know. It's such a positive view. I like it. I wish I could see it that way.
Turned the corner, bro.
I noticed. This is a different chip than I'm used to.
I'm telling you, man. It's this team I'm working with. They've got me so optimistic and in such a happy place with what I'm doing right now that I just can't. Like, it's hard for me to look at a day at work negatively these days. It's really difficult.
That's awesome.
I just enjoy it so much. I sat out here today and we talked about a whole bunch of stuff. We got a bunch of work done yesterday or 2 days ago. I sat out here and we got tons of stuff done. I never would have done that with other teams I've worked with in the past. But this is just, I don't know, man. We just compliment each other incredibly well.
Cool. Well, I dig it. You know, I think it's a pretty good segue to my second question, which, now, I think the hard one is over for you, right? Like, it gets easy from here. So the hard one's over.
Yeah, yeah.
So you survived it.
I did.
You survived it. So my second question.
I still don't feel like I ever answered it.
That's, you know
which
what?
Which was my goal.
Yeah, you did. That's
so
okay.
I succeeded.
That's okay. My second question is, of course, what is something you're doing you wish that every teacher would do? Also, that is the loudest clock. It's going to be in the recording. There's no way they can't hear it.
Do you want me to go hide it in an office?
It's too late at this point. It's already in the whole recording, so.
Yeah, it is like, and now every day because you said that, that's all I'm going to hear. Man, it's one of those things that I feel like is once again, it's so simple. But it's one thing that I did when I was in the classroom. It's one thing that I do here every single day. It's one thing that I've done constantly throughout my whole life. And it's building relationships. There is, in my mind, nothing more important that you can do on a campus every single day than build relationships. You have no idea how much you can get accomplished, how much more you can get accomplished with students if you just spend time getting to know them. Not just their names. Don't just memorize your roster. Get to know what they are. What do they do? You know, what activities are they into? What are their parents like? What's their home life like? Where'd they come from? Where'd they originate? How'd they get here? Because that leads to conversations. It leads to you becoming a person to them instead of, you know, like for me, I'm a dean over discipline. I'm the bad guy on campus. But I don't feel like the kids on campus view me that way. And I think that's because I spend a lot of time building relationships. I started a fishing club on campus because I have a lot of students that I know are frequent flyers in and out of here, but they also like to fish. So why not give them a chance for me to take them out and hang out with them, get to know them better, and give them something to do that's keeping them out of trouble? So I think, and I know, there are a lot of teachers out there, and I don't want to make a blanket. There are a lot of teachers out there who do an incredible job of building relationships. But as bad as it is, there are teachers out there who come in, they teach their lessons, they go home, and that's it. And they can hardly remember half their students' names. And I don't want to say that's a norm.
No, I wouldn't think that extreme of it is a norm. No, but no. You're right. I think there's – I wonder if it's, would you, now having been in middle school and high school, granted a limited scope, but would you say that it is more common the higher you go to not have those level of relationships, or less common? Like, what do you, would you be able to make a correlation like that, or you think it just is sort of a percentage of teachers that just don't find that value?
That's difficult for me to say. Because I can say from my perspective, there's no difference. But, I mean, for me, if I'm walking through a school campus or walking through Target or walking through Millennium Mall, I'm making friends and I'm meeting people because that's just what I do. That's like the fuel that keeps me going throughout the day. It's just meeting people, trying to make people laugh, trying to make people smile, trying to make people just open up. People who just seem like they don't want to talk, you know, just getting to know them, learning about them. I always feel like deep down I was really meant to be an anthropologist. Because something about just learning about other people and the way they do things and the way they live life is interesting to me.
It's literally the reason I became an English teacher is because I'm obsessed with stories. Like, yeah. I just want to hear your story.
Man, there was this great show on MTV a while back called World of Jinx. Did you ever see it?
No.
God, it was so cool. Anyway, hold on. I'll answer your question, then we'll talk about that. We'll just do a little side note. I think it probably dies off for a lot of people going into high school. And I think a lot of that is probably because of the autonomy that students start to develop when they're in high school. They don't God, man, I almost sound like a D word. They don't rely on teachers as much to guide them as, say, elementary and middle school students do. They've already kind of they're rounding the corner of what they feel is establishing their personalities, which they don't know. They've still got decades before that. But they feel like they have, and they're getting to that point to where they want to be independent. They want to be autonomous, and they don't, I think there's a feeling like they don't need that relationship as dearly as I would say elementary and middle school students do. But then, like I said, you know, for me and for a lot of teachers that I knew, that never changed. It was the same. The same here as it was at high school.
Okay. Yeah, and I think, I mean, certainly I would say middle or elementary school has a distinct advantage for the fact that they only have 25 kids a day, not 125.
Yeah.
You know, but I think certainly they have a distinct advantage. And I don't, yeah, it's hard to say.
25 elementary school kids.
Oh, yeah, no, that's terror.
Terrifying.
That's the single, no.
Yeah.
No.
Small children.
I subbed kindergarten one time. It was the worst. It was the worst day of my life. And I
would give anything to be a fly on the wall.
The fifth time this little girl brought me a colored picture to take home, I was like, I don't know you. I don't care about you. Why are you giving me this? Of course, I didn't say that. You know, I wasn't quite that unfiltered back then. But I get it. Yeah, I think. Obviously, we know, you know, it is a little tried and true that relationships are critical. But I think you're right. And it goes so far beyond that of like just getting people, even adults, building those relationships as a coach, its relationships are absolutely critical. And as a teacher, they're critical. I mean, and I think it's because it is so tried and true and because it is such a quote unquote small thing, it is easy to overlook. I think it's easy to forget about. That the depth of the relationship is how willing they are going to be to learn with you and work for you and do what you need them to do and help you when you need it. You know, I think that's a critical point.
And in a weird way, for me, building relationships with people is a way for me to force myself to be accountable. Because if I don't know you, if I know nothing about you, if we have no connection, then I have no fear of letting you down because I don't care about you. I don't know anything about you. But I feel like once I build a relationship, like right now, like I literally, and I know some of the teachers on campus would probably just brush this off and say, oh, there's no way that he even cares about what he's talking about. I legitimately lose sleep over the fact that I have yet to gather some chairs from surplus for some teachers on campus because they need them. And I understand that they need them. And I just, as soon as I get a chance to get over there, I'm going to inspect the chairs and order them and get them sent over here. I just got the contact for the lady today. But I stress about things like that. But the only reason that I stress about things like that is not because it's my job. It's not because I'm worried about getting in trouble. It's one, because they need them. But it's two, I stress out about it because I don't want to tarnish the relationship that I've built with that person. I don't want them to think that I don't care about them. And so for me, that motivates me. Once I build a relationship with somebody, I want to nurture that relationship. And so I feel like that makes me accountable for doing what I need to do, especially if I'm building relationships with my colleagues. It makes me want to work harder because I don't want them to view me as a person who doesn't work. And I also don't want to be a burden on them by not doing what I'm supposed to do. Does that make sense?
Actually, yeah. I hadn't really thought about it that way, but you're right. Because I'm thinking now about times where, you know, sometimes an email gets marked as read and gets buried and I forget to reply to it or whatever. And there's definitely a hierarchy of how much I care if that email has been replied to or not. You know, there's people that when I see them again and I realize, crap, I never answered your email, did I? I'm so sorry. And there's people that are like, did you get my email? I'm like, yes, probably. So I think you're right in that. Like, and I don't mean to say there's anyone at school I don't like, but there's definitely people I don't know as well. You know, I mean, our school's massive as well. You know, I have 150, even after the release school, I have 150 teachers. So yeah. I don't know all of them as well as I would like. You know, so I think you're right. I think there's definitely, that's an interesting way to look at it, that it forces you to work harder. And that's probably true for classroom as well. I mean, students as well. You definitely are, I feel worse about not reaching a student and not getting a student to learn if I know their story and know their life and know their situation than I do a kid that, man, I could never get that kid to open up. I tried. He just never clicked. And, yeah, he never learned either.
It's a difficult thing to say about students because I don't think anybody would say, well, I didn't develop a relationship with this student, so I'm not going to work as hard for them as I am the student I developed a relationship with. But that's just I think subconsciously you would do it anyway.
I think even consciously we play favorites. Let's be honest.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I definitely would think we play favorites.
I actively pick out the students on campus who misbehave or who are the most energetic students. and I will, man, I am their best friend. I am their best friend. Because makes them cry more when they get in trouble and they have to go on my office. because it's not like, man, I'm getting in trouble. It's like, man, Mr. Harmon's not going to be high-fiving me in the hallway anymore. Mr. Harmon's going to kick me out of fishing club. It's just, you know, it's a different thing. It's a different thing with a student you have a relationship with. It just means more, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think.
Also, I do not actively try to make students cry, so please don't. don't quote me.
No, of course not. It's just a natural part of your job.
But anyway, cut back. World of Jinx was a show on MTV where this dude, and I'd always said my whole life, like one of the things that's going to make me sad when I reach the end of my life is that I didn't get to experience these other types of lives. Like I've never lived in a big city where I had no car, where I took the subway, where I lived in like a little 100-square-foot efficiency apartment. I've never lived that life, but it could be awesome. It could be super fun, but I don't know that.
I feel like you would hate it.
And I probably would, but I would still want the experience.
Right.
I want to try it.
Yes.
Like I've never lived as an Aboriginal out on some completely undeveloped island. I don't know what that's like, but this dude made this show and I don't know why it ended. I don't know why nobody liked it. It was amazing where he went out. It was like two seasons. It was called World of Jinx. And he would go out and he would spend like an amount of time living the same life as somebody else. Like he did one that was like a person with autism, like extreme autism. He spent time with them and learned like what their life was like and how they got through their day. It was like an adult. He spent time with a homeless person. He spent time with like a rock star and like all these things just to see like what. And I was like, man, this show is like what I've always wanted my life to be. Like I just want to go around and that's why I say I feel like I feel like I was meant to be an anthropologist.
Now, the World of Jinx is done, so there's a void. You could create your own version of that. You could go live this life.
But then I think, but it flopped the first time, obviously, or it would still be around. And if it, and so, So it must be a bad idea.
I think just because it failed once is a definite factor that it'll never work in the future.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I think that's...
Does that ever happen?
Solid growth mindset. Solid growth mindset.
It's never failed once and its money did it again. And then, I don't know. It's just... Flashback over.
Back to where we were.
Okay. So yeah, so, relationship building. For a lot of different reasons.
Very cool. Yeah, I'm with you. Third and final question. Who is the best teacher you have ever had?
Oh, man. Oh, this is my favorite one. It's my favorite one because I always look for any opportunity I can to talk about my high school English teacher.
I feel like I haven't, you know, at the beginning of the show, it was English teachers all the time, and I feel like I haven't had any English teachers in a long time.
Man, this is, there's no end. Can you... I'm having an inner struggle here because I want to talk about him, but I know that your show is clean, and I feel like in order to do I'll do it as cleanly as possible, and I'll also stop sitting up and sitting back in my chair.
I keep doing it too.
Every time I do it, my chair goes.
This is going to be just, there's so much background noise in this episode. I'm either going to have to do some technical magic or miserable. I'm just going to have to put a warning at the beginning.
It's going
to
be miserable. But you know what? It doesn't matter to me because the one person who will never listen to this episode is me.
See, I'm going to make sure your wife knows about it and she's just going to play it in the house all the time. Oh, I'm just going to tell her, just let this play all the time.
Yeah, she's really getting into podcasts these days, so she may actually listen to it. My high school English teacher, John C. Kerbo. I will never, ever forget this man. He was, it's so funny we're talking about this because I was just talking about him last night. I'll get to why in a minute. He was a Vietnam vet with a peg leg, severely overweight. When I say he had a peg leg, I don't mean that he had, like, a prosthetic leg. I mean, he legitimately had, like, a disgusting, gross-looking piece of wood that had been attached to the end of his nub, where he got his foot blown off by a mine in Vietnam. I am not making this up. If anybody can find records on him, number one, good luck. Number two, he passed away probably a decade ago. Which is really sad, but he was so vulgar and so inappropriate and just so not what anybody would ever think a teacher is. He said things that to this day blow my mind. If anybody in any of these classrooms today said some of the things that he said to us, immediately escorted off campus. But he was the first person who showed me that you can be that type of person and still have a massive positive impact. Because if there's the only thing that rivaled his vulgarity was his passion for English, and literature and writing, and a lot of the stuff that he used to teach us was stuff that he had written. The first time I really experienced literary analysis was on one of his stories called Easter Morning. Okay, now, I want to let you know, I have not read this. I have not read this since then. And that was 17 years ago. So the details are going to be a little sketchy. But it was a story about Vietnam. And they were trying to capture this hill in Vietnam, his platoon was, and they were going up, and it was really detailed descriptions of, like, his friends and his comrades, like, dying next to him, and they get up to the hill, and they're struggling, and it's this massive inner struggle, because for the last few days, they've all been really sick, and they've super weak, because they've been throwing up, and they just can't figure out, like, what's going on, like, they start thinking that they've been poisoned, and they don't know what's going on. They finally get up to the top of this hill, and they take this command post that the Viet Cong have at the top of the hill, and then they go out the back door and they find that their field hospital is back there, and that's where they've been, like, amputating limbs and pronouncing people and then throwing them out into the river behind the cabin that behind the cabin into this river. The river flows down the hill, and that's the river that the American soldiers have been drinking out of for like the past days. And so that's why they were getting sick. And this whole battle occurred on Easter morning, and it was this whole like, once he lined everything up and showed us like the timeline of the story, and then also lined it up with like the story of Easter and the resurrection of Jesus and all of these things, it was like, boom, like my whole head. I was like, what? Like, it blew my mind. It was the first time that I had ever looked at a story and been shown how it could mean something other than what it's saying. And it was from that moment that I was like, oh, this class is good. Oh, this is interesting. You know, like this, I never took this class seriously. English, I hated it. I liked to read when I was younger, but never really looked deeper into things until I got into his class. And still today, and people, I feel like people who love English or people who love literature or people who had John Kerbo as an English teacher just have this ability to watch things, and this is leading to what Jeannie and I were talking about last night, to watch things and just pick out foreshadowing left and right, and to analyze everything that's happening in every scene, and to watch a movie and see something that to the layperson seems innate, it seems like
minor, unimportant.
Yeah, not important. That's a very uneloquent way of putting it. Uneloquent is probably also not a word. But you look at it and you go, why is that there? Why did they put that there? What purpose is that going to serve later in the movie? Because there's no reason why, for no reason, this movie director was just like, you know what? Let's get a cut of this guy putting an axe in the trunk and then not explain why he did it and not talk about why it's important. But I think it's one of those things that your mind kind of has to be trained to do, either just because you're naturally analytical or and you can see things like that. But I feel like every time we talk about it, it goes right back to I was in Coach Kerbo's class. And because I was in Coach Kerbo's class, he led me to always look deeper into everything that I read and always question things and always process information as more than what you see on the page. And he was great. And he also told me one time, first of all, he did not know any of our names. He gave us nicknames. And when he would go to put in grades, he would always say things like, boy! Or he called me Dennis. Because for those of you who don't know me, I look a lot like Dennis the Menace, especially when I was 14 and 15 and was rocking a sweet bowl cut. Probably a nice cowlick in the back too. He would say, Dennis, what's your name, son? Chip. Ah, there it is. Write it down. And he called me up to his desk one day, and he took his car keys out of his pocket after straightening out his leg with the peg on it. He reached over and pulled out his keys to a Ford nobody knows. It was just one of those cars where you look at it, it's like not a real model of car. It's like a car that's been pieced together by other cars. This man was the most interesting person I've ever met in my whole life. Virtually certain if I ever got to know him on like a personal level and like went and spent time at his house, the veil would be lifted and I'd be telling a totally different story right now. This is going to tarnish the image that I've built up for him right here. So be ready, people. If you don't like inappropriate things, just cut the mic off right now, or cut the podcast off right now. One thing he did was he called me up to his desk, straightened out his leg, pulled his keys out of his pocket, and said, I want you to go to my car, and in the passenger seat, there's a folder. That's all the papers that I graded last night. If you open the door and you don't see the folder, move the Playboys and don't touch my condoms. Not that you could use them anyway. They're Magnum size. And then he went.
Oh,
off campus. Done. You're fired.
I wish I was making this up. Had I mean, and the funny thing about it is, oh God, man, we are not going to get into the different time conversation. I probably did go home and tell my parents that, and my dad probably laughed. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Like that's the whole thing about it is, oh man, if a kid goes home today, and the, like I said, I don't want to, that is a slippery slope conversation. Kid goes home today and tells their parents, the teacher said something like that. They are sitting at the front door when the principal shows up the next day, for sure. He did that. He paddled us. We got paddled in high school. It was actually one of those things. We made paddles for him, and we would bring them in. You know, like the paddles from Dazed and Confused, the one with the bite taken out of it, and the one that said "fa" and then "q" on it. We'd bring those in and give them to him. When he got in trouble in class, instead of him calling home or instead of getting a, I don't even know if they had referrals at my high school. He'd take you out in the hallway. And he'd give you a good whack with a paddle, and he would come in and he would rate it on a scale, like a Richter scale. He was like, that was about a 7.2. That was about a blah. I mean, like, so it was punishment, but it was almost like fun. Like, people didn't really care. And it was also like one of those, can you take a, you know, like a 10.0. I saw him lift a kid off the ground one time, and he paddled him so hard. I mean, it was legit.
This is awful.
Yeah.
I don't even know where to go with this at this point. Like, where do we go?
No. But here's a when we read Beowulf, this is another one of those things, if you want to know how much of an impact his style of teaching and the way that he went into doing things impacted me, or how vividly I remember it. Because you can ask me about any other class the entire time I went to school, from kindergarten through 12th grade. And unless something happened, like I peed in my pants or some kid punched me, I don't remember any of it. But in his class, we were reading Beowulf. And he just asked a kid in class, he was like, does anybody here know how to draw? And the kid was like, well, I can kind of doodle. And he was like, okay, great. You get up on the board. And as we read Beowulf, he had this kid, like, illustrate the whole thing. And I'll never forget, it's the most ridiculous thing in the world. Because for Grendel, it was a dinosaur that looked like a Reptar from Rugrats. Okay? And then Grendel's mother, same dinosaur, but with the red kissy lips on it. So as if to say, oh, this is the same thing, just a female version. And I remember that, like, just, I mean, so vividly. I could take you back to my high school and sit you in the chair where I sat and show you exactly where those things were drawn on the board, because it's significant things like that that stick out. You know what I mean? And I feel like a teacher who didn't, and that was, you know, in those days, teachers didn't do that. Teachers didn't get kids to illustrate things on the board.
Yeah.
Because this was, I mean, I started at that school in 98 and graduated in 02. So that was, I mean, at least in a small town in Alabama, that was innovative. He was vulgar and he was inappropriate 95% of the time, but he was an innovative teacher who truly cared about educating students and loved English language arts and literary analysis, and did an incredible job of, I feel like, instilling that love in his students. And so that's why I say he's one of those people who showed me that you could be that person. Because those of you who know me outside of work, you could be that person and also have an incredibly positive impact on students. So, yeah. No, I love that question. I'm dying to answer that question. Only because he was like one of the most interesting people I ever knew.
I don't even know if I can air this.
Yes, you can. Just change the name to Roger Barnes.
No.
No, you can't, because nobody can prove any of that really happened.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
So what are they going to do, arrest a dead guy? Yeah. Have fun with that.
I feel like you're getting comfortable, though, because this is, like, starting to feel more. Like, the beginning was, like, this all very serious, positive chip, and now it's, like, starting to feel like, oh, yeah, this is the chip I'm used to hanging out with at a table.
Yeah. That's what I was just talking to. I was talking to that person. I was talking to Mutters this morning. And we were talking about your show, and I said, I really wish that he would do, like, a like a secret sideshow where we could all sit around as educators and loosen up and like really say the stuff that, we want to say. You know what I mean? When we're not, because you sit over there and you smile and you're going to say something like, I want you to say what you really want. You don't want me to say what I really want.
I was actually going to say that I'm pretty honest on my show.
You want me to go back to the interview? You want me to give the people what they want? Mancha, mancha, mancha. But I mean, it's really hard for me to control my words.
I know.
School's out. School's over for the day.
I know.
I've been watching my mouth all day.
maybe that's a project for the future. That's a project for the secret sideshow.
Call it choir practice.
Choir practice. That's I like I, it.
Never mind.
I like choir practice.
Delete that.
Eighth period.
Mm-hmm. I liked eighth period and I used eighth period. And then I met a very, very wise person. Who
hopefully a future guest.
Yeah. Oh, whew. But yeah, that would be phenomenal. Have you asked him?
Not yet, no.
Okay. Also,
I don't know how much of this is even going to make it on air at this point, but...
What?
Well, I mean, it's going to have to get cut down. It's a little long, so...
Simply Balanced soda waters, for no apparent reason whatsoever, bulge out on the bottom. So, at the beginning of the show, I took a sip of my soda water, and I went to sit it on the desk... And
which is now a rounded bottom.
Like a seal ball on the bottom of it. I had to like lean it on its side so it's like sitting at a cockeyed angle on here. Why is it? How long have we been talking?
Like we're right at an hour.
Oh, that's
not too bad.
I feel like optimal podcast length is between an hour and 45 minutes.
Yeah, is that your opinion?
I like a long listen, though.
So I just started a new show. By the time this releases, my new show will already be like 4 or 5 weeks in.
You started a new show?
I started a new show this week. Today, as we're recording this, it was today. And we started a student podcast.
What?
So we're calling it, currently with my tech ed kids, we're calling it Studicotomy, like student dichotomy. And the reason for that
nobody's going to get it.
It's okay. It's written out. It's a tweet. It's fine. We're calling it Studicotomy, and they'll figure
it's
a it out. Tweet. It's like they'll figure it out. It doesn't matter.
It's etched on the walls now.
The reason we started the show is because the reason for this dichotomy portion is it's my students talking about two topics, and it's like a 15-20 minute thing, right?
Okay.
And it's one utterly ridiculous topic and one real topic, but we're talking about both at the same time. Because you've been in my Shref Tech class before. They're nuts. Yeah, I mean, my kids are insane all the time. Though. They're awesome.
And they're really smart, so that makes me excited for this podcast because I like – there's nothing more that I enjoy than hearing smart kids say smart things.
Well,
because it impresses me. It makes me like hopeful for the future of America.
The first episode focused on Twix candy bars.
Right, which is actually my favorite candy bar.
And the necessity for higher level thinking and conversations that are driven by student inquiry in school.
Okay.
And the reason we were focused on Twix was because we had... When I started to talk about this idea was the left Twix, right Twix thing, like, which, you know, like left Twix, right Twix. And he said, I want to talk about why that's a thing. Like, is that just an ad campaign or is there something more going on there? Like, is something deeper happening? And of course, he's being funny, but he's at the same time, he's like, it seems ridiculous because he's just trying to pull a meme. By the end of the first day when he suggested this, by the end of the day, because with my kids, they kind of come back and forth and they'll, if they have a downtime in a class, they'll come to my room or they'll come during lunch. And so my veins of conversation continue throughout the day. And, by the end of the day, one of my students had said, if you split a Twix, a left Twix and a right Twix in half and put them together, what do you have? And I said, whoa, our society is not nearly accepting enough to allow this sort of intermingling of left and right Twix. That's unacceptable. You can't. And I motioned to like putting the two ends of a Twix together. He goes, no, you're misunderstanding. He goes, what if you cut the Twix lengthwise? So that now you have the left side of a left Twix and the right side of a left Twix. And you have the left side of a right Twix and the right side of a right Twix.
That's bananas. Man.
And I said, does the left side of a right Twix, is it a self-hating right Twix or is it just a more accepting of other left Twixes?
That's a... Was this kid hot?
I don't think so. But he said it, and it blew my mind.
That's insane.
It blew Twix's mind, too. I included them in the tweet. They just literally just were like, they literally gave me like 800 mind-blown emojis and just can't compute.
That's insane.
Yeah. So that was our debate in the first one.
This is probably going to gonna enrage, possibly confuse some people. I eat both Twix at the same time, like it's one full candy bar.
But do you buy a left pack or a right pack? Because now that I know way more about Twix than I ever wanted to know. But they make the two lefts and the two rights now.
I don't. I grab a Twix. I open it and I eat both bars at once, like it's an ice cream sandwich.
That's insane. Why?
Because none of that concerns.
Well, even ignoring the stupid ad campaign, that's just a weird way to eat them.
Why?
Because you open it, you pull one out.
Why?
Because I don't know. I'm not a heathen.
Pull one out.
Because I'm not an animal, Chip. I'm a human being.
No, you are an animal because by pulling it out, you're going to allow that chocolate to melt all over your fingers, or you can just hold the wrapper and eat.
Now we have to do a follow-up episode of Studicotomy to talk about the proper way to eat a Twix.
Yeah.
Because other people eat it from, like, the top down, like, the layered top down.
Oh, my God.
Like, they eat the chocolate, and then the filling, and then the cookie, and then the last layer of chocolate.
People like that need a hobby. They need something to fill that extra time in their life that they feel like they need to fill with eating things in a ridiculous fashion. Because, I mean, even if I started to eat something like that, there are times when I'm trying to watch what I eat, where I'll take a piece of candy, like a single M&M, and I'll put it in my mouth, and I'll just let it dissolve slowly, because I feel like that's giving my mind the same amount of endorphin release as throwing a handful of M&Ms in my mouth and eating them in 10 seconds. So, I mean, I will have to, like, try to prolong that.
But by the fifth M&M, you've done that. You've given up.
Oh, by the fifth M&M, you do that. You go, I'm just going to eat a handful. This is ridiculous. All I was thinking we do is want more M&Ms. Okay, we
could probably cut this at this point.
Well, now that I'm on here, I'm afraid that you're not going to publish my show because I was too real.
Oh no, it's going
about my English teacher.
Let's be honest, it's going out there.
And his potty humor.
Do you have any idea how much work it would be to cut that out? I'm too lazy for that.
That is true.
How many times have you heard me say on the show, "Oh, I can edit this out later"?
Yeah. I should have guessed that.
Well, Chip, you know it's been real. It's been fun.
It's definitely been real.
You survived it. You survived it.
I did. I feel no differently than I did before we started.
You don't feel any better about that first question? It's going to keep you up still?
It is. I'm going to analyze everything I said the whole time anyway.
Like I said, I'll make sure that your wife at the very least plays it on repeat in the house.
Yeah, because, so, I mean, in all reality.
Just every time. Like, we need to start a movie for the kids, and then your voice is going to start coming from the TV.
I'm going to plug my ears and run out of the room. Because I feel like we talked forever. I feel like I didn't say anything. At least nothing of value.
That's how I feel about all my shows, to be fair.
And but, honestly, we've been sitting here this whole time. My radio's been all the way up.
That's a miracle that hasn't gone off.
If anybody caught it, it's on Channel 2. But had anybody, man, that would have... would have wrecked anybody listening to the show.
Well, Chip, I appreciate it. Thanks for being on the show. Do you have Twitter or anything like that? Anyway, they can reach out to you if you have questions.
No. If you have questions,
reach out to me. I'll get them to them.
You can find me on Snapchat, Roger Barnes. Roger. It's also legitimately just Mr. Harbin. You can hit me on Snapchat. I don't think
you're the first guest ever to throw out their Snapchat.
I don't really Snapchat that much. I mostly look at things that people Snapchat, but I think it's a cool tool. On Instagram, don't do that. That screen name is embarrassing. or that handle. Why did I say screen name?
It's a screen name.
Was it AOL Instant Messenger?
My screen name is what is it? Dennis124 or something.
Chip Hop 1.
Chip Hop 1.
What's your screen name? Yes. Chip Hop 1. Is my Instagram name, I'm pretty sure.
I think mine was Leave Me Alone.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Because I was super angsty.
I used to have one that was Fat Earther.
Okay.
Instead of Flat Earther.
I like it.
That's good.
Yeah. I like that.
Yeah, so.
Cool. A whole bunch of ways you can't get a hold of him anymore, so, you know.
Yeah.
That's good. Very useful. Yeah. Useful information for my audience.
Yeah.
Chip, I appreciate it. Thanks, man.
Hey, thanks for having me. It was fun.
Listening back to that, I noticed two things. One, I laughed a lot in that interview. And two, I laughed just as much listening back to it. I hope you all really enjoyed it as well. If you have questions or comments about the show, or you have questions or comments for Chip, you can reach out to me. I'm on Twitter, at Brad Treffler. I always love to hear from you guys, or if you're interested in being a guest on the show, I'd be glad to talk to you there as well. Until next week, keep pushing towards the best that education can be. Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio. Your voice is right here.